So Parshas Tazria Mitzrayim is the double parsha this week. One of the more difficult parshas to pick up after a couple of weeks off is a very technical series of parshios which discuss primarily two series. The beginning of Parshas Tazria discusses the laws of childbirth as it relates to a woman after having a baby, the laws of Tumah and Tahara, of spiritual purity and impurity, whether or not she has a boy, whether or not she has a girl, various laws. And then we get into the laws of Tzara'as. Tzara'as, as you are all familiar with, often mistranslated as leprosy. It's really not leprosy, some type of a spiritual malady that affects, as the Torah describes, three various parts of a person's life. The Torah describes it. It will affect a person's actual skin, a discoloration of the skin, little splotches of red and of white and of yellow and of hairs in the middle, all sorts of technicalities that's described in the Torah. It can affect a person's clothing, and it can affect a person's home. As I'm sure you've all familiar from previous years as well, Chazal basically traced this concept of the spiritual malady to Lashon Hara. This is a effect that happens if a person is not careful with their speech and with various other shortcomings that the sages see and relate to this particular spiritual malady will affect them, this type of tzara'as, in one of its various forms, be it in the form of skin, clothing, or in the home. So the section that I would like to focus on this afternoon is in the second of the two parshas, Parshas Metzor, page 624, specifically tzara'as on houses. This is actually the third form which has been discussed in the previous parsha, in the first parsha, Tazria. The Torah discusses the first two, tzara'as on the skin and tzara'as on the clothing. And then the Torah describes part of the purification process, and then it goes back and describes the third form of tzara'as, which is the form of tzara'as on the house. We'll go through some of the verses inside and see what we can see and learn what we can learn. So let's start with the following premise. Getting tzara'as on one's house is a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, okay, yeah.
I would say it's bad.
Right? Gut reaction has got to be bad, right?
The message from Hashem, though,
so... Okay. So in other words, so we'll get to some other aspects also. So what I want to discuss is a couple of seemingly contradictory aspects from the sages and how they addressed and treated tzara'as at various levels and work through them a little bit. The starting point would be a person whose home is affected with tzara'as, we would not look at that in a positive light. He's getting a message from Hashem. That's a positive. We'll see in a moment exactly how positive. Let's start with that even right now. Let's start with that. I'm going to put that thought on hold. Let's start right away. Verse 33 and 34 is where we begin this section. Vayidaver Hashem al Moshe v'al Aharon lemor. Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aharon saying, Ki savo'u el eretz Kanaan asher ani nosein lachem la'achuzo. When you arrive in the land of Kanaan that I give you as a possession, v'nosati negod tzara'as b'veis eretz achuzos chem. And I will place a tzara'as affliction upon a house in the land of your possession. Now, that's the introductory phrase. So let's just break down this phrase. What do we see in this particular pasuk as we introduce the concept of tzara'as on a home? What are some comments you would have on this verse?
Well, something bad that happened in the house.
Okay. What from the text of the verse itself, what jumps out at you? What phrase seems to be, or phrases are...
Hashem is doing it.
Okay, we see Hashem is doing it. That's one. What else? We'll go get to that. There's a phrase almost that's repeated.
Oh, in the land of your possession.
Excellent, right? So what does that tell you?
Almost that it's good.
And okay. Well, before that, you're even on a deep, on the most surface level.
It happens only in Israel.
Right. As the Gemara will learn out, exactly as Dina is saying, this law, the law of tzara'as on a house, is going to be limited to the land of Israel. It does not take place outside of the land of Israel, as the pasuk seems to say. When you arrive in the land of Canaan that I give you as a possession, and I will place a tzara'as affliction upon house in the land of your possession. Beis Eretz Achuzos Chem. It's a home a house of yours in the land that I have given to you as a possession, the land of Eretz Yisrael. So Rashi points out, the Gemara learns out from here, that the concept of tzaras is limited to Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's significant because of the point that I wanted to start with, which Dina had mentioned earlier. This is a message from Hashem. The Ramban describes at length. This is really an absolute bizarre concept, which we are sort of familiar with from the fact that we read it every year. We talk about tzaras as tazria mitzvah. These two parshas come across every year. Concept of these afflictions on the homes. This is an absolute bizarre occurrence that a person wakes up one morning and there's a green or red splotch on the walls of his home. It's just, it's sort of unfathomable to think that, you know, you're like, you come home from shopping, you got all your bags from Kroger, and you tell me, like, what's that? And you look close, and sure enough, the wall turned green.
Mold.
Or red. Right? You take out your 409, and you take out your mold remediation, and you start spritzing and scrubbing, and ain't nothing happening. It's not mold, and you're looking carefully, it just turned green. It's just bizarre, and then it grows, it shrinks, it moves. It's a very supernatural occurrence, the fact, the whole concept of tzaras, at least on your skin, we have all sorts of maladies. That's not the most bizarre thing. Bizarre, but not as a... But then when we get to our clothing and our homes, really unnatural kinds of occurrences. So the Ramban discusses at length this unnatural, supernatural, miraculous event as a message from Hashem. It is the Ribono Shel Olam, Hashem speaking and communicating with us in such manner. And he writes, and that's why the Torah stresses that it's only the Veis Eretz Achuz Laschem. It's only in a home in the land of your inheritance. The connection that Hashem has with the Jewish people, the relationship, the direct, you did this, therefore I do this, you speak like that, your home will look like that, that kind of relationship, we are not privileged to that. Just anywhere and everywhere. It's the kind of thing where, as poor as we may be with our mouths now, but we're not even on a level to deserve this punishment of tzaras. Because as much as it's a punishment, it's a communication, it's a message, it's a lesson, it's a form of prophecy almost, and that's limited to Eretz Yisrael. So in that regard, we can say it's good. But I don't mean like it's good, it's a negative type of prophecy, it's a rebuke. So in whatever level of goodness we can find in that, we can. It's limited to Eretz Yisrael. You have to be on a high spiritual plane, even to be zocha, just to warrant and merit receiving tzaras. We should all be on such a level where we could be zocha to receive tzaras. It's like a bracha that we could give ourselves. So in that way, yes, it's a good thing. It's like that funny kind of bracha. I could say, wow, we should be zocha to be on such a spiritual level that we get punished in such a manner. We're not even there now. We should be in our tishah b'meir b'meir and receive such a punishment. That would be a step up from where we are. But bottom line is it good or is it bad? It's bad. It's bad. The sages say, why are we receiving tzaras? We receive it because of the way that we speak. Other things, the Rambam has a very long discussion at the end of his discussion of tzaras. He has almost a full page in which he discusses, and I'll just read the first line just to bring this point home, as he says, "V'zeh hashinoi is an ois upela." The fact that Hashem changes the nature of the world and He brings these colors into your homes is an absolute sign, a wondrous sign. V'yisrael kedei lehazhiron miloshon hara, to warn us about the way that we're using our speech. Shamisafir b'lashon hara mishtanos kiros beis. So someone who speaks lashon hara, those walls will change. Im chazar bo yitoher habayit. If he will take the message and return from his ways, then the house will no longer be affected and everything will be good. But if he's oimei b'risho, if he remains in the way that he's been behaving, then it will move to his clothing, says the Rambam. And if he doesn't change his way after it hits his clothing, it gets even closer to home, it will actually hit his actual skin. That's how the Rambam sees the progression from one's home to one's clothing to one's skin, moving from away from him, closer towards him, this message the whole time. So if a person gets tzaras in his home, it's a sign that something bad is going on and he has to receive the message. Now, with that in mind, let's read the first Rashi that we studied here in Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Rashi says as follows, it's on page 624 on the left-hand column of Rashi. The Nosati Negot Tzaras. Rashi is bothered the language, even in English, it gives us the same implication as in the original Hebrew. When you arrive, I'm reading the verse again, when you arrive in the land of Canaan that I will give you as a possession, and I will place tsaras, affliction, upon a house. Does that sound like the kind of thing that says, if you misbehave, you will get this? Or does it sound like the kind of thing that says, I am going to do this? Right, the language is, this is what's going to happen. So the sages were bothered. On the one hand, they understood this to be a punishment. It's a response to you. If you speak Lashon Hara, if you don't use your mouth appropriately, this is the punishment you'll receive. Yet the verse does not give that implication. The verse actually gives an implication as, you will get to the land of Israel, and when I do this, this is how you respond to Tzaraas. This is the process. You go to the Kohen, and so on and so forth, as we will read in a moment. So the sages were bothered by the implication. They say as follows, Besurah Yivohem. It's a message that this will actually take place. It's a piece of news for the Jewish people. Shehanegoyim boyim aleihem. Because the Amoroyim, the Amorites who lived in the land of Canaan before the Jews arrived, would hide their gold in the walls of their homes. They knew that the Jews were on their way, traveling through the desert into the land of Canaan, which was known as the homeland where Hashem was bringing the Jewish people. They didn't want the Jewish people to have all of their wealth. So they used to hide it in the walls of their home. And then when they were expelled, as the Jews moved in, but the Jews didn't know that their homes were sitting on such value, when the tsaras would come, part of the process, as we will learn in a few moments, is they'd have to take apart the walls where the tsaras affected it. And they would discover, lo and behold, the jewels and gold and silver of the Amoroyim who had lived in the land of Canaan previous. So it comes out a little bit of a funny thing. We're punishing a person for inappropriate speech. The other thing I must mention actually here, which is appropriate to mention, that we'll see also in the Medrash, is a certain tsaras ayin, a certain selfishness with one's possessions. We're going to see what's going to happen to one's possessions in the home. There's a certain lack of sharing, selfishness, which is taking place in the home. And so how do we punish such a person? So we punish them with tsaras, which would seem to be a pretty negative thing, the whole process is we're going to discover. And yet at the end of that process, what happens?
Rewarded
with possessions? It's a little bit odd when you put the two things together, that it should be specifically the person who's being punished for a combination, as we'll see, a little bit of selfishness, a little bit of Lashon Hara, not being concerned about the other, putting themselves up. That's the person who we should say, let me share with you good news, Hashem tells Moshe in the desert. When you get to Canaan, I'm going to send you tsaras. You'll have to destroy your homes, and you'll end up being wealthy. I'm going to transfer all the Amorite wealth to you in such a manner. Let's put that on the table for now and move forward, shall we? Okay, next. Okay, we'll just leave that as question number one. Okay, so further in the Pesukim. So Hashem says, you'll come to the land of your inheritance. I will place these neged tsaras in your house. And this is what now happens. Pasuk Lamed Hei, 35. Uvo asher lo habayis. The one to whom the house belongs shall come to the Kohen. Lay more saying, Kinega niro li babayis. What should the one to whom the house belongs say to the Kohen? Something like an affliction has appeared to me in the house. A couple of funny things about this verse. What strikes you as odd about this verse?
Like an affliction?
Right, what should he say?
Something happened in my house.
Good. Okay, that's point number one that the sages are going to point on. Why does he say, kit nega? Something like an affliction has hit my house. And it's green and it's red on your wall. Go to the Kohen and say, there's a nega on my house. There's an affliction. Come look at it. He doesn't say that. He says, Kit nega, something that looks like a nega is on my house. Now, why does it go to the Kohen?
More instructions.
Why not to the Godol Hador, to the Talmud Chacham, to Moshe Rabbeinu?
Then the Kohen has to tell him how to get rid of it.
Excellent. So as we see here, as well as this again, this is the third discussion already. We skipped past the tsaras on one's skin and on one's clothing. Only the Kohen can declare a nega to be tsaras. Rashi points that out here as well. Rashi says that you go to the Kohen, and even if you're a Talmud Chacham, you know, you need to go, we'll get to it. You need to go to the Kohen. The Kohen is the one who actually is the one who does it. This is, by the way, which is not our discussion for today, but it's worth mentioning, is part of the process for someone who speaks Lashon Hara. Someone who speaks Lashon Hara is using their mouth in a way in which one of their either justifications or arguments for doing so might be, I mean, what's the value of a few words anyway? It doesn't really make much of a difference. I'm not really hurting them. I'm not, you know, causing them anything. And so we know, of course, that that's not true. The words that a person says are extremely powerful and have a tremendous potency to them, and they can affect people for their entire lives. People have been affected by something which someone said to them, a parent or a friend said to them when they were a little kid. It takes them with them forever. So our response to the person who speaks Lashon Hara is, you think your words aren't powerful. It doesn't matter what you see on their wall until the Kohen comes and declares it and says, it's Tame, it's Tzaras, nothing happens. And as soon as he says it, then it becomes Tzaras. It's all based on his words declaring it to become Tame, and then it's going to be his words which are going to eventually declare it to be Tahar again, that it's pure, and everything goes based on the words of the Kohen as another lesson along the lines of, don't think your words don't matter, they matter a lot, as will be impacted here specifically from the words of the Kohen. Okay, that's one point we need to discuss. Kinega, why does he say it as it looks like a affliction? There's another odd phrase here in the beginning of the verse. The one to whom the house belongs shall come. It's a very wordy way of saying the owner of the house. Even in the Hebrew, Uva asher lo habayis, the one to whom the house belongs shall come and say to the Kohen, Kenega Tzaras. It looks like a little bit of the Tzaras. So some of the commentators explain that this is also part of the problem. The one to whom the house belongs. Part of this guy's problem is his sense of, this house is mine. I am the owner of this house. This is my stuff. And it's a perspective on material possessions, which we're going to be discussing a little bit more as we continue, this idea of the selfishness, this is my house. So the Torah is already beginning to stress as he begins his corrective process, like, you now have that splotch, the one to whom the house belongs. That's a root of the problem. The one who thinks that this is all his, and it's all about him, and he's the owner of the possessions, he goes to the Kohen and makes that declaration of, it looks like Tzaras. Now, the Mishnah picks up on the second phrase. Why does he say kit nega? Why does he say it looks like a nega? So the Mishnah presents, or the Mefarshim of the Mishnah, the commentators on the Mishnah, when the Mishnah discusses the halachas over here, presents two reasons why he should say that. Reason number one, kidei lachlik kavod lekohen. It's to give honor to the Kohen. Because the Kohen is the one who's going to come and declare it. So imagine the two possible scenarios. One is in which the Jew comes to the Kohen and says, I have Tzaras, come and declare it. At which point he's already saying, I've made a decision. I know what it is. I just need you to put your rubber stamp on it. Versus when the Jew comes to the Kohen and says, there's something on my wall, I'm not sure what it is, come take a look. So the Mishnah says the Torah wants the Jew not to come to the Kohen with his mind already made up and the decision already having been made, and you just want the Kohen to put his rubber stamp on it where you're just sort of using him. This is the Kohen. And you need to bestow a certain honor upon him, and therefore when you approach him, you don't say to him, it's Tzaras, say the words Tameh. You say to him, it looks to me like it might be Tzaras. Come take a look and tell me what you think. Which is a beautiful lesson in how we ask questions. Now, if you ask somebody to ask questions where I've already made my decision and I just need some sort of a rubber stamp from whoever it is that I'm asking a question, some boss, a superior, a rabbi, whoever it may be, a spouse, versus, I think it might be like this, you know, what do you think? So here, where the Jew actually needs the Kohen to make the declaration, so he doesn't say to the Kohen, this is what it is. He says, Kenega. It looks to me to be like Tzaras, and therefore the Kohen is the one in the position who actually makes that decision. That's reason number one, the commentators of the Mishnah explain why he says that. A second reason is offered, and that is, Lomad l'shuncha loymar eini yodea. A person should become accustomed to saying, I don't know. And therefore, the lesson the Torah has here is that when you approach the Kohen, learn to say, I don't know. So instead of saying, I know what it is already, it's Taras, come and do your thing. You say to the Kohen, something is on my wall, I don't know what it is. Can you take a look? And it's something that we as human beings need to be trained in to do, to be able to respond, I don't know. And therefore, the Mefarshei HaMishnah say the reason why the Torah says that the statement the Jew makes is, can't nega, it looks like a nega, is to train ourselves into saying, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, I don't know. I don't know everything. It looks like it to me, but I'm not sure what it is. And it's another one of the many ways that within a story, the Torah tries to teach us various other lessons as to how to use our language and to get accustomed to being able to say that. Beautiful lesson. The Maharal writes a third reason why he thinks a person should say this language of kinega, and that is to distance oneself from ever speaking sheker, from ever saying something which is not true. Because what would happen if the Jew comes to the Kohen and he says, it's Tsaras on my wall, and the Kohen comes and takes a look and says, actually it's not. So that a person shouldn't even have said that when it's not true. So, says Noel, again, the Torah is trying to train us in a sensitivity. Since you're not the one making the decision, don't say it is before you know what it's going to be. Even if you're pretty sure for lots of other reasons what it is, that's not how you talk. Since it's going to be in the hands of the Kohen to make that decision, and until he actually says it, it is not. So then the words you use are, it looks like Tsaras to me. The Kohen will tell you whether or not it is or it isn't, but don't say the words it is if what's going to turn out is that it is, in fact, not. So three beautiful, amazing. This is one of the depths that I just find fascinating about the Torah. The Torah is a very simple verse. All it's saying here is that the Jew finds a splotch of red or green on his wall. He's got a problem. So the Torah says, go to the Kohen and tell him. Except the language the Torah uses is you should say to him, kenega, it looks like an affliction. What's the difference? Okay, a little odd. There's an extra letter. Instead of nega, it says kenega, like an affliction. And you have these three beautiful lessons in there. One, to teach honoring the Kohen, that you shouldn't tell him what to do, but you defer to him and you say, it looks to me that way, what do you think? Or to teach a certain humility of getting used to saying the phrase, I don't know, I don't know. It's like so the Torah knows us so well. The author of the Torah, the author of our essence and creations, our existence, knows we don't like to say that very simple phrase of, I don't know. So we'll make up all sorts of things in order to be able to have an answer. So the Torah like sneaks in with a single extra letter, kinega, to teach us to say, I don't know, I don't know. Just get used to saying that, because if you're not used to saying it, you'll never say it. That's just the way that we go. Or the Maharal teaching us the sensitivity of you don't want to ever say something that's not true. And since it's not based on your words, it's based on what the Kohen's going to say in a few minutes, until he says it, don't say that it is, if it might not be. So we use our words, and it's, again, the whole parsha is teaching us the sensitivity of language, so this is the most appropriate place to teach us these lessons, with an extra letter, the extra chaf, to teach us that sensitivity. Teaches that sensitivity. Okay. Fine, so now we're up to, so the Jew finds his splotch, he goes to the Kohen and he says, come look, it looks bad. I want you to take a look and see what's going on over there. Lamed Vav, 36, Vitziva HaKohen, the Kohen shall command, Ufinu es habayis, b'terem yavo HaKohen liros es hanega. And before the Kohen even comes to look at it, they clear out the house, the lo yitzma kol asher babois, in order that the items in the house should not become impure, they should not become tameh. The achar kein yovo hakohen liros es habayis, and then the kohen will come to look at the house. So the Jew comes to the kohen. The kohen is in the middle of doing whatever he's doing. He's in the basement. She's learning as the kohanim were wont to do. And the Jew says, "Come quick! There's a green splotch on my wall that looks like it might be tsaras." Kohen says, "Clear out the house before I get there. Clear out the house. Clear it out." So they go back home, and they take all of their stuff out, all of their utensils, all of their clothing, everything comes out of the house, as if they're moving. Everything gets placed on the front yard. Now there's nothing in the house, and now the Kohen is able to come and take a look at this splotch. Why are they doing this? What does the Torah itself say?
Shouldn't spread.
Not that it shouldn't spread. What does the Torah say?
Well,
shouldn't become contaminated. Now, contaminated is a funny word. It means tamei. Meaning that if the house becomes declared to have tzaras, if that is in fact what happens, the house will become tamei, the house will become impure, and then everything in the home will become tamei because of the level of tumah that tzaras creates. It's like having a corpse in a home. If a person walks in, he'll become tamei by being in the same home. So the vessels, the pots, the pans, the clothing, the things that the person has will also become tamei. So the Torah commands, in order that that shouldn't happen, all of the materials should be sent out first beforehand.
Were there certain Kohanim that this was kind of what they did, or should all?
I would imagine so, like anything else. You know, they needed to be an expert, so they would study. So there probably were the Kohanim who were the experts in Hilchos Tzaras, I would guess. But even if not, then what would happen is the Kohen would have a Jew, Talmud Chacham, as his sidekick, and the Jew, Talmud Chacham, would say to the Kohen, yeah, that fits the Halacha, that's Tzaras, and then the Kohen would say Tzaras, because the Jew couldn't do it. But he would have his Talmud Chacham who would tell him. But I imagine the process would be, the Kohanim would rather have done it themselves, and they would have a special Tzaras Kolel, and they would study the laws of Tzaras, and they would become experts in it. That's what I would imagine would happen. I'm just guessing, I don't know. Okay, the Medrash points out another reason why the Torah requires this person to clear out his house. What happens to this person when he clears out his house? Now, a person who's got a little bit of a selfish trait in him, doesn't like sharing his things, also doesn't want people to know what he's got, because they're very likely they're going to ask him to borrow it, or they'll know what he has. So part of his punishment is he's got a little sidewalk sale going on. When he comes and he runs to the Kohen and he says, I have Tzaras, this is not quiet. He's now got to take everything in his home and put it out there in his front yard. His entire front yard is now filled with every material possession that he has is now brought out, which is going to be a humiliation and an embarrassment for a person who's been a little bit stingy or selfish with his stuff. It's now all out there for the public to see. That's one aspect of what takes place when this happens. Again, in a furtherance of trying to teach a midah of sharing of oneself, of not being as possessive of the house to whom, the person to whom the house belongs, of not being so possessive of one's material goods. The Mishnah adds, as Rashi quotes as well, there's another reason why, or lesson, the science for the selfishness of the Torah is trying to impart onto this individual. And the Mishnah says as follows, as Rashi quotes from the name of Rabbi Meir, what is the Torah so concerned with by making you take out all of your utensils, all of your pots and all of your pans out? Certain types of pots, let's say you have a metal pot and it became tamei. What do you do with a metal pot that became tamei? Anybody know? You can purify it. And that's where many of the laws of we learn about mikvah come from, purifying of pots and pans and metal things and wooden things that became tamei. They can be immersed and they can become purified. So the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, is very bothered by this like whole process. Like, what are you saving me? You're saving me by schlepping all of my stuff from inside the house to outside the house. And then what do I need to do with it afterwards? Schlep it all back inside the house. And if I wouldn't have done that process, and it became tamei, what would happen? I'd have to do the same thing, schlep it all out of the house, bring it to a mikvah and purify it, and bring it back. It's like, what did you really save me by making me go through this entire process of taking the stuff out of the house and then putting it back in? Would I have lost my utensils? Would they have become unusable? No, they just would have to become purified. So, but it's not like you're not making me to go through a lot of energy as it is. As it is, I got to take everything out of the house and then bring it back in on a risk, because maybe it won't become tamei. This way, I for sure have to do it. And even if it would have become tamei, so alright, so I have to purify it. So I take him to the mikvah, and then I bring him back, and everything is where it is. So the Rav Meir is very bothered, like, well, what was the Torah so concerned with that it makes me, in order that they shouldn't become tamei, I have to take all the stuff out and bring it back in? What's the big deal? So Rav Meir comes to the conclusion, it must be, the Torah is only trying to salvage the types of pots and pans that could not be purified. What type of pot or pan cannot be purified?
Ceramic,
clay, earthenware type of pots or pans cannot become purified. Those types of vessels, if they become tamei, have to be broken, which is the Torah's way of saying making them unusable. As long as they're in their usable form, they're tamei and they can't become purified. So Rabbi Meir concludes, it must be the real thing that the Torah is concerned with is salvaging your clay cheres, your earthenware vessels. In a scale of like 1 to 10, if you have to list all of the value of all of your pots and pans, you got your earthenware vessels and your wooden vessels and your metal vessels, which are the most expensive and which are your least expensive?
How the least is the pottery?
Right, without question. Your least expensive vessel is your earthenware vessels. Those are the cheapest things. You can pick them up for a few dollars even today. There's no question. Your earthenware, if you go to a home goods store for your pots or for your flower pots, those are the cheapest of all types of things. Your wooden and your metal pots and pans are going to be far more expensive than your earthenware. So Rimea says as follows. So this entire process of clearing your entire home so that it shouldn't become tamei is not really to salvage your wood and your metal, because that we could have dealt with afterwards anyway. We would have salvaged it. What's the whole reason why you need to clean your house? To salvage your earthenware vessels, because those could not have been salvaged. Those are your most or your least expensive utensils.
Well, if you're real poor, then
that's all you have.
Yeah. What about furniture? Clothes.
So the clothing can be purified.
But, I mean, you couldn't purify a couch.
The couch.
Or a bed. I mean.
You can dump my mikvahs.
Depending on how big.
There's a concept of dumping beds and mikvahs, isn't
it? If it's depending on what it's made out of. And if you're thinking of your, and the type of couches we have today would get ruined.
Right.
I would imagine by being immersed in a, but I,
it was
yeah.
Probably wood or stone.
I don't know what it's made of, but that's fair. So Rameir comes to the following conclusion, that if the Torah is concerned on mamono habozoi, on the least valuable possessions that you have, kal v'choymer al mamono hachaviv, it's to teach a lesson. The Torah wants to teach you something. I'm even concerned with your small little pachim kitanim, your small little vessels that you might otherwise not care about. I want you to know that I care about them. And I don't want you to lose them. So I want you to clear out your house to make sure that you don't lose your earthenware vessels. To teach you how much more so you need to value your more expensive items. And from there, if you value your expensive items, you'll come to value how much more so you'll value more important things, like even the value of a life and all the, and the mission has a list of things that you'll come to learn, which is all started by teaching you an appreciation and a value of even your smallest items. Now, it comes out to be a little bit funny, because what was the reason the Medrash presents why we make this guy clear out his things? Because here we got a guy who's being a little bit too selfish. He's holding on to his things, so we say, put it all out there for everybody to see. Clear them out. We want you to, everyone should be embarrassed and humiliated, but for everybody, they should see what it is that you have. And then he's the guy that we want to teach a lesson to by saying how much we value even the smallest little thing. Don't waste anything. Isn't this a guy who's been stingy and holding on to everything? So why are we showing him that even the smallest thing is of value? He's suffering from that. He's suffering from wanting to hold on to all of his things a little bit much, and yet he's the guy that we want to show to spare even the smallest value, and then this is the guy that if it continues and we take apart his house, what's he going to find in his house?
Gold
and silver? Like where? Where does the Medrash come in saying that there's a selfishness problem here that we're trying to address? A person who says, this house is mine. The person who we need to put it all out there that everybody should see what you've been hiding. And then at the same time, there's this idea of we're teaching them the value of even the pachim ketanim, even the smallest little utensils have great value. Take care of them. And we're going to give you gold and silver in your homes. Just seems like a lot of contradictory things going on at the same time. So I want to share with you a thought from Rav Zev Leff, who's a well-known Rav in Israel, an American fellow who's lived, is now a Rav in Eretz Yisrael. So he wrote, so I saw an article that he wrote, the following idea. This idea of pachim ketanim, of the small little utensils, comes up, where does that remind everybody of?
Yaakov,
when he crossed back over the river by himself to spare himself even the small little pachim ketanim. And there the sages say that tzaddikim, the righteous ones, value chaviv aleihem mamonam, their monetary possessions are more dear to them, yoser migufon, more than their own bodies. because his body he put at risk to cross over the river by himself. And it was all to do what? Just to save a few small pachim ketanim. Strange statement Chazal make, that Yaakov would value his possessions as a small little pachim even more than his body. Was that? That's a righteous person? It seems like against the way that we look at monetary possessions. So Rabbi Lev said as follows, when we're talking about here, we're talking about earthenware vessels, the pachim ketanim, the small little earthenware vessels was by Yaakov, and over here, specifically the Mishnah points out, they're earthenware. Earthenware vessels have a very unique series of laws when it comes to the laws of Tumah Tahara, purity and impurity. Number one, we mentioned already, is that it's one of the only types of vessels which cannot be purified. When it becomes Tameh, you have to break it. There's just nothing you can do for it. What I left points out is that there's another very unique aspect of it in the way that it becomes Tameh. Generally, a utensil can become Tameh when it comes into contact with a Tameh-carrying object, an object which creates Tameh, whether or not it's an actual corpse of a human or certain types of animals or a person who came into contact with a level of Tameh. If you touch or move the vessel, then the Tameh transfers to a certain point from the carrier of the Tumah, so to speak, until the vessel that it comes into contact with. An earthenware vessel is unique in that if the source of Tumah comes into contact with the outside of the vessel, it does not impact the status of the vessel. Only when it comes into contact inside the vessel. So if I have an earthenware bowl, and let's say a sheretz, a dead rodent, were to come into contact, which could cause Tumah, it came into contact with the outside of the bowl, does not cause Tumah. It has to, you'll excuse it, what's going to make you all sick to your stomach, it has to actually come into contact inside the bowl. Oh, he's a human being who's Tumah. A person went to a funeral, now he's Tumah, and so if he picks up the bowl from the outside or touches the bowl, it's not moving, it's a separate, so if I touch the bowl from the outside, it would not become Tumah, but if I put my hand inside the bowl, it becomes Tumah. So Rabbi Lev writes a very odd halacha, that it should only become, the only one that's like that it only becomes Tameh from inside as opposed to from the outside. So he suggests a beautiful idea as follows. There are two ways to measure the value of an object, of a utensil that you would have. One would be to measure the material, the value of the material from which the object was made. Is this plastic? Is it wood? Is it metal? Is it fine china? And the nature of the object that the material was used to make the vessel will determine its value. So that the same bowl or the same cup will change value based on whether or not it's plastic, a soft plastic, a hard plastic, a wood, a metal, a fine china. You could lay 100 cups in front of you, and they all have the same functionality. The difference is going to be, what is it made out of? And that will determine the value of this particular cup or glass that's in front of me. That's in terms of how we measure a utensil's value based on the material that was used to make it. The second way that we would measure the value of a utensil is its functionality. What does this do? What is its value to me? What can I do with this? A utensil which has very little functionality, made out of the same material of another utensil, which has a great amount of functionality, will be vastly different. A shard or a little flower pot, which can only hold a flower, will be far less valuable than the same earthenware material, which can be used for something of greater value. So the value placed on the utensil is not going to be based on the material, but on its functionality. An earthenware vessel only has one measure of value. Most utensils can be on either scale. If I have a metal utensil, I can either measure it based on the value of the metal in the utensil or the functionality of the utensil, and usually its final value will be a measure of both. Earthenware utensils only have one measure of value, which is functionality. Because what it's made of, there's no value in the earthenware. No, that's
also limited in what can be used.
Okay, but it might be limited, but that's the only way you would measure it. There's no value in the material. In other words, wood or metal has a value, intrinsic, and then you take an intrinsically valuable metal, material, and you make something out of it. So its total value will be comprised of both its inherent intrinsic value plus its functional value, and you'll come to a final value price that you pay for it. Earthenware, the actual earthenware material itself is basically as cheap as it gets. It doesn't have a high value. Its value is measured only by the functionality that it has. Says Rabbi Lev, so the Torah stresses that in the way that it could become tameh. When you touch something from the outside, that would be an indication of its intrinsic value. That you're coming from the outside, does it have an intrinsic value or not? So materials which do, metal, wood, and others, can contract tumah from the outside because they're intrinsically valuable items. But earthenware doesn't have any intrinsic value. Its only value is functionality. So how does it become tameh? Only when you affect it from the inside of the vessel, which is where it's used. When you have the tumah come to contact from the inside, where you're now impacting its functionality, then you now have tumah. But from the outside, where you're addressing only its actual intrinsic value, earthenware doesn't have any intrinsic value. So far, so good? And by left, right, that's really the idea that's being taught here. The idea of earthenware is to teach us a lot. Even when we have a Jewish perspective on all of our material possessions, even when we have material possessions made up of materials which are intrinsically valuable, the Jewish approach to material possessions should be, it's not intrinsically valuable, it's only valuable in its form of functionality. This is a tool that I have been given to use for whatever the tool is. So that I might have a lot of possessions, but all of my possessions are really functions or serve a function for me in my service of Hashem. Whether or not it's to take care of myself, take care of my family, whatever it may be, but I don't look at them as things that I gain and get and collect for the sake of having intrinsically, but I want to view all of my things in the way the Torah teaches me to look at earthenware vessels. They only serve a functional purpose. So the person who gets tzaras on their home, who's suffering from a measure of stinginess and selfishness, what does the Torah say to him? Clear out all of your possessions. As Remeir says, what are we really concerned with? What's the only type of possession that he has that we're most concerned with that can't ever be fixed? His earthenware vessels. Everything else he could have fixed, but he couldn't fix his earthenware vessels. And to this guy, we say the Torah is concerned about your earthenware vessels. Pay attention to them because they're very valuable. What's so valuable about your earthenware vessels? Because your earthenware vessels teach you the essence of all of our possessions. It's the type of possession which is unique in that its only value comes from its functional value. It doesn't have any value other than that. But its functional value it has. And we care very much about the Torah says because that really is a very important idea. In the same way as a righteous person values his possessions even more than his body, because they are both tools given to him to serve a certain function. But his possessions are even more valuable than his body, because his body he got for free. He didn't do anything to deserve it. God gave it to him. But his possessions he needed to work for. So these are the tools that I've now earned to be able to use in my service of Hashem. Everything that I have, every possession that I have, all the money that I have is here to serve a function. Not just to have, not just to be, not just to collect. I need to serve a function, which is the lesson which is taught by the earthenware vessels, which is why Yaakov goes back for them, because even his pach and ketanim are very valuable to him, in that these small little earthenware jugs all have a function, and as they have a function, I need them. Whatever that function may be, but I have to have everything that I've been given. So to this guy with tzaras, who needs to clear out his home, is to teach him the real value and purpose of his possessions, because he's been suffering from that. So he clears them all out, and he learns how much Hashem cares, even about his small little earthenware vessels. And if he learns his lesson right, that's why, what happens when he destroys his home? Then he'll find all of these possessions. He writes it as if the Torah is saying, first you need to learn a lesson. First you need to take all of your possessions, and you need to clear it all out. And you need to be able to say, this is what I have. not keeping it to myself, I'm not hoarding it, it's not that I don't really want to know, this is what, after all that humiliation, the embarrassment, the things that you've been hiding all those years, it's now out there for everybody to see. And I want you to know how much the Torah values even your small little earthenware vessels, but you don't care, but you need to know that's what you need to care about, because that is a very important lesson, the earthenware vessels, that the true value is not from the external, the true value is not from its intrinsic value, its true value is only measured from its functional, that what do you do with this? How can you serve Hashem with this? Now that you've got this, we have more wealth for you to discover. The wealth that Hashem wanted to give to the Jewish people that the Amoraim had been hiding in their homes, when a lesson is learned and the new value is placed, so what you'll discover as you take apart your home is not just the pain and suffering of destroying your home, but you'll actually now find newfound wealth buried in the walls after having learned the lesson that Saras was meant to teach. Then you're in a position to learn the lesson and to receive the bountiful plenty that Hashem has to bestow upon us through the walls of your home and the stuff that you find that's been buried. That is his thought on that, and we didn't even get very far into the actual story. But that's the basic process, and we're going to have to go through the rest of another time exactly how as that happens. So those are some thoughts on Saras and Kinega, and I'll leave you with that, and have a wonderful week. It's good to be back.
Cool.